Hi, family, I'm Sam. I'm an alcoholic. So God must have a profane mouth. That's all I'm saying. Just as God made me. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Where's Arno? Where's that misogynistic bastard? Where is he? That guy's made me right. He's made me more spiritual in the last 48 hours than anybody in my whole sobriety. That guy's given me so many resentments over the last 48 hours. I'm like, oh. I've never met anyone more offensive than myself till I met Arno. I was like, it's not just me then, is it? It's not. It's not. He's like that. Yeah, it's you, brother. What, me? We're doing the reverse. Raymer started the spiritual, and then we're ending with the raisin on the end of the hot dog. Isn't that what it is? Yeah. I'm the raisin on the end of the hot dog. So I brought, this is my journal. So, and it would be great if you feel like it, if you would sign it. It'll be up here and you can write whatever you want in it. And, you know, so that's that. That would be cool. I'll find you some blank pages. Try to use the blank pages. Don't go to the part where I'm whining and complaining about Arno in there. Just kidding. Wow. Well, I don't have the words to say thank you so much. Thank you, thank you, thank you for having me, and thank you for whatever it took to get us all here. And I started feeling the impact of being here, the power, man. How long do I have to speak right now so that I know, because I'll probably take these long pauses. How long, brother? An hour, okay. So on Friday night when Chris started to talk, actually, I think it was when Smadi came up and then you guys were reading the steps, I started to sort of cry because I couldn't believe that I was in another country and hearing another language. It's the first time I've ever heard the program in another language, and it was powerful for me to hear it. And I thought, I can't believe that I'm here in a country where I don't speak the language and they're talking my language and they're talking about my family, talking about yourselves. So it was awesome. And it's just a long way away from the car with no windows that I used to live in, you know. I used to be homeless, but I didn't call it homeless. I called it camping. It was camping, it was adventure. And so thanks for having us, and thanks for everybody staying sober, and thanks for the old timers that have come before me. Thanks for surviving yourselves, because I know that this program, the disease rests in my mind, and it'll always be in my mind. It's not about my feelings, it's about my thinking. And so, you know, that's one of the things that I hear the most is, you know, well, I feel bad. I feel bad and I need to drink. And I understand the feelings. I understand because I thought I drank because of the way that I feel. But really, I drank because of the way I thought. And what I mean by that is the story that we have, the stories that we tell ourselves. I mean, I'm going to come up here and tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And what we start talking about is the story. And that's why they call it war stories. And I don't really have a problem with people qualifying and telling me their war stories and telling me how bad it was and how much they did. I don't mind. I mean, it is the, you know, what Chris talked about. That's not what we're really trying to relate to, or relating to the feelings and so on and so forth. But like Norm Alpe used to say, man, he's one of my favorite speakers. You know, he said, I don't know how to better tell you about alcoholism and about Alcoholics Anonymous than to talk to you about how I drank. So I'll tell you a little bit how I drank, but the fact of the matter is I really didn't drink that long. You know, I started young and I got sober pretty young, you know? And so I didn't have these long drawn out years of drinking, you know? I mean, I started getting loaded at 9. So, and I'm sure, I mean, that's probably pretty late in life for some people. But like I say, you know, I could have used a drink long before then, but it was sort of hard to score with, you know, like a Partridge Family lunch pail. That's what I had when I carried around in fourth grade. And so it was just easier to start with drugs, you know? And if you're one of those people that never did drugs, you know, you're a purist, then all I can say is I'm sorry, you missed out. And, you know, missed out on ecstasy and methamphetamine and, you know, acid. But anyway, somebody, oh, Jesus, Larry was, I leaned over to Arnie last night. I'm like, I think I'm getting triggered when Larry was talking about the glue, you know, the glue sniffing. I was like, and that explains a lot about Larry, actually, now that I know. Because that shit is whacked. Is that for me, Omar? Doc. So I'll tell you about my story. Story that we're all in bondage to. The story that totally doesn't make me an alcoholic, but anyway. So I'm the youngest of four. I'm the only one that was adopted. Like I said they wanted to have three and adopt three, but after Samantha, that was enough. That was sort of the joke at the cocktail parties. And let's see, and I'm an incest survivor, and I really didn't think it was incest. It didn't hurt. It was like a game. They called it Slave Girl. It felt pretty good. I don't know. It's like, you know. So I don't want to make light of it, and if you're one of those people that's survived the touching and the bad stuff, I feel you, and I know it's really hard to get through and everything else, but the fact of the matter is that shit stopped so long ago, and I kept living my life kind of like I was sharing with you yesterday during the four step. I kept living my life and recreating situations that would put me in that position where either I was a victim or a victimizer. And so thank God coming into this program, I learned I could make a new story. You know, and I came into this program thinking I was so different because I was adopted or because of the molestation or because of this or because of that. And the fact of the matter is I found thousands and thousands of people who felt exactly the way I did, who never had that experience. So that I had to stop playing those cards, you know. I didn't have to, but in this room, it didn't work. And they would tell me things like, we really don't care about where you came from. All we care about is what you're willing to do today, you know. And so that was sort of the thing that as much as it offended me, it also began to set me free. So, you know, I got sober the first time they threw me in a drug rehab when I was 17 years old. And I had been seeing shrinks from the time I was 5 on. So there was obviously, the message was clear that there was something wrong with Samantha, right? And I've been in therapy for years and years and years. And by the time I was done with therapy, before I got into this program, I was well aware of what the problem was. But we had gone through the issues of abandonment and not good enough and blah, blah, blah. But no one ever gave me any solution. They're like, you know, well, yeah, you're fucked. Okay, I got that. Now what? You know what I mean? So, you know, that's when I got into this program, you guys described to me a lot of what they had described to me in step one. And in step one, it was just like, you're screwed, you're screwed, you're screwed. But anyways, I digress. Let's see. What got me into the drug rehab was I drank and used drugs. And I had a little attitude problem, allegedly. Like I said, I hated my parents, didn't everybody. And they were annoying because they seemed to care. They're just always up in my shit. You know, where are you? Where are you going? Did you go to school? Why didn't you go to school? You know, you're not gonna go out like that, are you? And just annoying, just in my business. You know, I'm 13 years old, I got it. Ugh. And they'd always play that parent card, you know. Well, when you know, as long as you're under my roof, you'll, you know, that whole, oh, my kingdom for my own home at 13. But anyway, so they threw me in this drug rehab, and this was the first time that I had ever heard that maybe I was sick and not bad. They brought in hospitals and institutions, and And, you know, and I really hadn't done, I mean, however much you can do in the suburbs of California, you know, I mean, Pasadena, my dad's an orthopedic surgeon. My mom is a house mom. You know, I'm, like I said, I'm the youngest of four. I'm significantly younger, 10, 8, and 6 years younger than my siblings. And so, you know, I really, it was the white upper class, upper middle class kind of thing. And raised Lutheran, you know, and all that stuff, did the whole church thing. And you know, I'd go to church every week loaded, and which, you know, I felt the spirit, if you know what I'm saying. And it's so funny because my mom and dad, you know, they got into recovery the same time I did, because when we went to this drug rehab, they had to do family groups and stuff like that, and they were introduced to Al-Anon. And are there any Al-Anons here today? Yay, Al-Anons. Embrace Al-Anon, everybody, because if you stay sober long enough, that's where we all end up, trust me. because I love alcoholics. And I have to learn eventually where I stop and where you start. And Al-Anon's been huge for me for that. But anyway, which is why I handled Arno so well this week. I must love him, really. I think I must love him on some deep level, because I think he's just like me or something. But like I said, I've never met anyone more offensive than myself. And he likes it. God. So anywho... So my parents got into Al-Anon, and in the 80s, when I went, the late 80s, my Al-Anon was really geared for more for spouses with alcohol problems, and they kind of, from what my mom and dad, this is more their story, but I'll share a little bit of it, is that they were a little bit uncomfortable sharing about their teenager and the drug use and so on and so forth. So, and like I said, I don't ever apologize for the whole poly substance outside issue thing. I put gin in a syringe and stuck it in my arm, so I never know really what program I belong to. But this one seems to do just fine. You know, and people will say, God, you put gin in a syringe. You know, why not just drink it out of a glass? And I was like, well, because I have a perfectly good syringe. You know, doesn't that make sense to anybody? Who... So if you have that love affair with needles, then I understand. It's like I'd put ice water in there if I could. I just think it's swell. But it's so antisocial. They just... You know, you're going, I remember always trying to sort of be a social user, and they'd be doling out cocaine or something, you know, and you get up there and you're like, can I have mine in a spoon? You know, they just go, no, ooh, gross, you know, and so then you're just kind of like trying to get it into the spoon and, you know, but not really, you just can't wait to get to the bathroom to get it in the syringe. So that's a whole nother love affair and a whole nother addiction, but the fact is, you know, I will, you know, take alcohol in any form and anything thereof, anything that'll separate me from God, anything that's a distraction from the truth, capital T. That's what my path was all about. So, and I really didn't know how awesome the truth was. Painful, yeah, but awesome. And so I really feel like if you're a relapser or if you're struggling with the steps or whatever your path might be, if you're really having a hard time with that, you know, my experience is that you're going to evolve with or without your ego's permission. Breathe that in. That you're going to die this lifetime or the next, clean and sober. So anytime you're ready to just step up to the plate and be divine, you might as well just step up, because that's what's going to happen. That's our deal. But I could be wrong. Anyway, so my parents were really starting to get into this program called Families Anonymous, which was specifically for parents with kids with drug and alcohol problems. And like I said yesterday, they just started to be black belts in this whole thing. So we all kind of started to recover at the same time. And we would do split pitches, and we would go around and talk about what it was like and all this stuff. And I would always sort of laugh to myself, because their experience was, Samantha, you know, we knew she was high when she was just so nasty. And I'd be like, bitch, that's when I was coming down, you know? When I was high, I was like, hi, Mom, hi, Dad, cleaned my room, everything's great, did my homework, yada, yada, yada. You know, and they thought that's when I was sober, you know? So, the world of ignorance and misunderstanding, as Larry talked about. So, anywho, yeah, like I said, my first drink came disguised as skunk bud. It was in the form of, you know... I was over at my friend's house. We were in fourth grade, and her older brothers dealt pot. And I saw her older brother stick this big bud in this huge bong, you know, and it's just like clear glass with all this beautiful butterflies and all this stuff on it. And I watched him pack that thing and light it up and just, you know, and just the smoke would curl up, and then he'd clear that chamber, and I was like, wow, you know, and that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. And I hadn't even had any yet, and I was in, you know what I mean? And I smoked marijuana that day, and I fell off their roof and ate a lot of almond roca candy, and that's all I remember. And it was good times, and I couldn't wait to do it again. And pretty much everything went downhill from there. You know, 8 years later, I'm put in this drug rehab, and they bring in hospitals and institutions, and all I remember hearing in that first meeting was that maybe I was sick and not bad. And for me, looking back on it now, I didn't have the vocabulary or anything, but for me, that was hope. And I didn't stay sober from that point on. I stayed sober for quite a few months, though, and I really got the deal, got a sponsor, worked the steps, so on and so forth, 17 years old. In and out after that for a little bit, came back to the program. I was about 19 or 20, and I stayed sober for what I thought would be the rest of my life. And I was very active in the program. I stayed sober 6.5 years, and then I quit going to meetings. And those are the 5 most infamous words I hear. I hear 5 things the most when I ask people what happened. I hear, I quit going to meetings. I didn't do a 4th. I didn't do a 5th. I didn't do a 9th. And I didn't do a 12th. Those are the ones I hear the most. I know chicks 6 or 7 years that, you know, 6 and 7 years sober that don't sponsor. And I'm blown away. You know, and that's why I say that's when my compassion sounds like a loaded shotgun. You know, it's just like, are you fucking kidding me? You know? Because as the guys talk about before, is that's the dope. That's the dope. You know? That is the stuff that we really stick around for. We don't know that we're sticking around for that in our first year. We don't know that when the old timers are just distracting us for our first year, they're just babysitting until God kicks in. You know, they're like, I don't know, wash the cups. I don't know, set up the chairs. I don't know, come help me with my laundry. I don't know, do my dishes. You know, whatever the deal was, it's like they're just babysitting me till God kicks in. You know, because once God kicks in, it's like you're out, you're gone. It's bye. You know, and we see the light come on and we see helping others. And I'm saying the first year, you know, like you got to wait a year. I don't really need to beat this dead horse, but you know what you guys have had up here this week is like, do the steps, 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 do the steps. You know, I love the fellowship. The fellowship has saved my life. The fellowship has also nearly killed me. In a lot of ways. I mean, not to blame the fellowship, but I'll tell you, like I said, we can be nasty. You know? I know we say we don't, you know, shoot our wounded, but how many times have we said, that guy again? That guy's not serious. That guy doesn't want it. I'm the first one. I'm guilty of it. Like I say, I'm spiritual enough to know where I can't be spiritual. You know what I mean? So if the guy keeps coming in, lots of girls, I tell the girls, I don't say to women I sponsor, you know, or people that ask me to sponsor them, I don't sponsor slippers. I don't say that. I've had a couple people that do say that. That's fine. They don't. So be it. That's their ideal, whatever the deal is. But for me, what I do say is, if you want what I have, then you'll do what I do. And I say, I never fire women that I sponsor. Never. Don't have to. I say, you will fire me. Oh, no, never. You know, well, okay, that's great, sure. But here's how it'll work. How it'll work is I'll ask you to do exactly what I was asked to do. And not only what I was asked to do, but what I did. In fact, I'll tell you what I was asked to do. And then I'll tell you honestly if I did it or not. Right? I will be authentic with you. Because otherwise, it's bullshit. And it doesn't do anybody any good. I don't need to look cooler than I already do. I don't need to be better than I already am. It's like, this is the best you got right now. This is the best Samantha that I can be. And we got a long ways to go. I mean, spiritual speaker, what the fuck? You know what I'm saying? It's like, this morning, I don't have any hot water, and I'm just like, what the fuck? You know? I'm gonna be late. I got up early, I ate breakfast, I prayed, I fucking prayed, you know? I asked you to help me, be nice. The fuck? I stick my head out, you know, like heads are gonna roll at this. And who do I see? I don't even know this guy's in the program, but this guy walks by, John, He just walks by. He's walking by, poor guy. I'm like, naked, like a towel wrapped around me. He's like, hey, I go, hey, what's the, how do I dial? And I can't dial this, I can't dial the front desk. I'm dialing zero, beep, 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 zero, 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 beep, beep. I get my glasses on. I'm trying to read the phone. I can't read the phone. I'm trying. There's like no number for the fucking front desk. You know what I mean? Because I got to go speak spiritual shit. I got to go save some lives here. I have to shave and stuff. Do my hair and look really pretty. Is that my phone? Oh, that's the church bells. I was going to give someone shit. Turn off your phone! Oh, it's the church bells. How much more time we got? I'm tired. So John says, I'll tell him, you know. I'll tell him. Does she have any firearms in there? I'll tell him. He comes back and says, you can go shower in my room. My wife is in there. And I'm just like, okay. Like, oh, my towel. He brings me a little robe and everything. So, why would that make me cry? So I go, and his beautiful wife's just getting out of the shower. My head kind of goes to some weird sex place. I don't know. Sorry, I don't know. And so I get in the shower, and it's nice and hot, and I do everything. Ah, everything's good, and I go, and of course, I've locked myself out of my room. So the maid opens it, and everything's fine, whatever. But the fact is, you know, this is the best you got. It's the best I can do, you know what I mean? It's the best Sammy there is today. And, you know, and the old man didn't want to come with me. It's so weird. This is okay. So you've heard this, Vancouver. So the last time I spoke, well, I spoke in Australia like a month ago, but with the CD or this pitch that Austra there heard was when my old man and I broke up and I had already paid for his ticket. You know what I mean? And so here we are again. I don't know if we've broken up. I'm dating my ex-husband, okay, which is interesting. We've been divorced for 8 years and never really stopped loving each other. It was just whatever. We're too young. I don't know what the deal is. Anyways, he's got 15 years sober. I got 14 years sober. Everything's been great. And then something in February, I don't know, he had this little meltdown where something triggered him about our past. And we've been dating for almost a year now, and we've, you know, with a lot of communication, all this stuff, I don't know why I'm telling you this, it must be necessary, so we'll just go with it. Okay. And basically, he just had this meltdown, and I looked at him, I was in Santa Barbara visiting him, and I said, you got some unresolved issues about our stuff, huh? And he's like, I don't know, I guess so, you know. And it just came to me, and I asked him, this is going to be on xmspeakers.org. Oh, fuck it. Anyway. I said, just out of curiosity, sweetie, I go, have you ever done a formal fourth step on our breakup? And this guy sounds like one of the chicks I sponsor. No, but da-da-da, and he went on about this, and I listened, and I thought, and I just looked at him, and once he looked at me, he knew. And I just said, that's interesting. I go, you mean to tell me that the most painful experience in your entire life, by your own admission, you've never done a formal four-step on? Come on, bro. And right then I knew I had to go home. Like, I had to get out of that car, and I had to go home, and I had to give him whatever space he needed to do, because I have done the work. I have so done the work. And I hung my head low for a lot of years. And at 7 years sober, nearly took myself out. Because it wasn't about drinking or using anymore. It was about the shame that I could not raise myself above. It was about going into the fellowship and people judging me and hating me and leaving terrible little notes on my car because I had fallen off some pedestal that I should have never, ever been on. And I'll tell you what, for reasons I cannot explain, I stand before you here because even the medical community is like, don't understand. And I, you know, and I'll tell you, that was a huge experience for me. And lots of four steps and lots of therapy and lots of Native American stuff and everything I could get to, trust me, was trying to set this child free from the hand that really was my own perpetrator, that I was in this cage by my own hand, that I was both in the cage and the jailer. And that's, you know, that is way beyond staying clean and sober, which this program has very little to do with in regards to alcohol and drugs. I said yesterday, this is not about drugs and alcohol. This is about this God thing, or as I prefer, dog. But anyway, this is about evolving to the place where I have this connection, where I have this constant connection. Now, I don't know about you guys, but in America, we have these GPS systems in our cars. You guys have these somewhere? So for me, there's no more like, you're blowing it, you're not working the steps, you don't have a good program. It's I get off the GPS system. I get off the path. And my God is, like I said, it's very polite. It's like the GPS voice, you know, please return to the highlighted route. Please return to the highlighted route. And you can turn her down, you know, you can turn that bitch down all you want. But the thing on your screen is still like, please return, highlighted route, right? And so the further you get off, it just gets beep, 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 you know. So eventually you're getting back on the path. And eventually you're back on the highlighted route. And so that's kind of what it is whenever I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, that's why I say it's a third step issue for me, because I come back to the highlighted route. So I quit going to meetings. 6.5 years sober. I'm at a bar with my first husband and a girlfriend, neither who had ever seen me drink. And it's always fun to tell non-alcoholics, you know, you're a recovering alcoholic, because they really don't get it. You know, they're like, that's terrific. Well, that's neat. That is really special. You must be very proud. That's great. But they don't really get it. You know what I mean? Little uncomfortable. You know, they are a little uncomfortable. As they sort of push their wine to the side, like, right? They got it that night. But anyway, so I haven't had a drink in 6.5 years, haven't been to a meeting in about 6 months. And I just reach right over, and I'm always the designated driver. We go to bars, shoot some pool, whatever, no big deal, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, for reasons yet obscure, I just reach right over and drink a half a glass of white Zinfandel. Because the thought came to me, and here's what the thought was. Maybe it was a phase. I think it was a phase. You got sober really young, and, you know, you never really were a wine drinker. And it was really drugs. Drugs were really your problem. And I forgot that I'd really never drank out of glass when I drank. So the whole thing was new. It's a whole new world. It was just new. So half a glass of white Zinfandel, silence at the table, right? And then my girlfriend reaches over, and she pats me on the knee, and she's like, well, good for you. That's great. That's terrific. Now, this is why I speak. See, no matter where I go, no matter who asks me, no matter how many people are in the room, no matter what, this is why I speak, so that I don't ever forget that this is what happened to me. Because it's not for you, this is for me. That a voice clear as day, said very quietly to me, here we go. And the next scene I remember in that bar is me banging on the bar going, I want something to help me drink longer. I know, it's so classy, broad. And the bartender's like, ixnay on the ethamphetamine may, you know what I mean? And from that point on, I was arrested 11 times and put in 5-point restraints and got my 2 bottom teeth knocked out and ended up in Atlanta, Georgia. Because I'm an alcoholic who slams methamphetamine, which makes me a very busy alcoholic that gets nothing done. And is rather scandalous in the process. So anyway, you know, we rape and pillage for a while, whatever. And then after stabbing the man I loved, because he was leaving with a full jar of peanut butter, as best as I can remember, which makes no sense to me now since I hadn't eaten since 1994. But here's the thing. Everything I judge, I walk through. Let's say that again, shall we? Everything I judge, I walk through. I've had these huge lessons of life. And the lessons are so valuable that they've left deep scars. So the value of the lesson is directly proportional to the price you pay for it. You see, you pay a big price, very valuable lesson. Let's have some scar tissue around that one. And so the valuable lesson that has hit me so far is when I was sober 6.5 years, I was a counselor for a family organization. And I had one client who was she was married, she was young, and she was in a very abusive marriage. And I used to say to her all the time, "What is wrong with you? You just leave. Just leave. What's the problem? You just leave." And I'd help her leave, and I'd call the cops, and I'd do this, and I'd do all my diligent, you know, all this stuff as a counselor. And one day I told her, because I'm so loving and compassionate, something to the effect of, "You know, you give my gender a bad name." That's like 16 violation codes of ethics. But anyways, I was fed up. And I said to her, "You know, you give my gender a bad name." And I was thinking about her as my old man was strangling me, because he wasn't a hitter, he was a strangler. And he would strangle me to the point of unconsciousness, and I'd wet my pants or mess myself, and then I would come back to consciousness, and he'd be hovering over me with this mildly amused look on his face, and you know. And I'm not going to get into the whole, no one deserves to get hit. No one, I understand, okay? You know, you want to come up to me after the meeting, like I said, it's my experience, you'll lose, okay? But here's the deal. I deserved it. Now, however you want to take that is fine. I'm not saying I'm some victim or anything else. I'm just saying that my mouth ripped him apart. I ripped away his masculinity, his humanity. I completely terrorized that man and tore him from limb to limb verbally, to the point where I'm just saying, we co-created this together. I own half. Because when someone is verbally abusing you to such an extent, at some point, you're just like, "Shut the fuck up!" It's like you can't even talk anymore, you know what I mean? Now, in my defense, he had like 7 prior, you know, felony spousal abuse charges on his record, so he had an issue or two. But the fact is my place is I created that situation. And it's also in my fourth column in the fourth step. These are the consequences of my alcoholism. So I was tired of getting strangled, and it was getting old, and I picked up a knife, and I just doink, right in the head. And I was like, blood, you know, and the head wounds are so gnarly, because it's really not that bad, but it looks so bad, you know what I mean? It's like gushing. He's on the phone like, "You bitch," and he's fine, you know, he's talking to me, but I mean, the guy's still talking shit, and he's bleeding from his head. Anyway. I hear the sirens, woo, coming down Jimmy Carter Boulevard. I'm like, it's time to go, you know? And so I jam. I got my little barnacles outfit on, you know, this like little t-shirt and shorts and an apron. And I'm like hauling down Jimmy Carter Boulevard. It's good times. Anyway, and long story short, somebody who sold me marijuana, my pot dealer, great guy, drove me all the way from Atlanta, Georgia to California. And he'd say silly, silly things to me like, "Why do you have to drink so much?" You know, like there's an answer for that. And the only answer I would come up with is, why don't you? You know what I mean? I don't know. Why don't you just smoke pot? You know, and I'd think, I don't know. I don't know why I can't just smoke pot. Could be because I'm an alcoholic with an allergy and a phenomenon of craving and obsession of the mind. But anyway, you know, the interesting thing is, what was going on with me when I had the thought that it was a phase? You know, was I that far away from the foundation? I was that far away from the herd. And I don't know about you guys, but you know what? When you get some time sober, people start to look up to you. So at 6.5 years sober, people thought I was the shit. They didn't really get me. I had an awesome career in radio for a long time. I was working at a big rock and roll radio station, and I was, you know, jumping out of airplanes and doing live remotes from bungee jumps and, you know, big shows and all this stuff. And so even without the meetings, I had a profound alteration in the way I reacted to life. So I was still different, right? And so that's why she sort of patted me on the knee, thinking, you got this thing. Because everything in my demeanor shouted, I had arrived. So the whole thing goes back to this thinking, feeling, acting thing. And so this is the stories that we come up with that sort of defeat us. So he drove me all the way to California. I remember walking up the steps to Casa Serena, which is a woman's recovery home, and you know, seeing all these teeth and all these happy girls and manicured everything. And the first thing I wore, I mean, the only thing I wore for the first 7 months of my sobriety was Uggs, sweats, flannels, the back of my head was shaved, and my two bottom teeth were knocked out, which is total vision for you, I know. And I remember at 7 months sober, my sponsor at the time turned to me out of the blue and said, I want you to start wearing a dress once a week. And I was like, now what wanted to come out of my mouth is, are you kidding me? That's not in the big book. I'm not doing that. Yada, yada, yada. But I was so terrified at the thought of having to wear a dress. And she, like, relentlessly deepening my dilemma. Like, she didn't even stop there. Like, that wasn't abusive enough. But she goes, and brush your hair. And I go, on the same day? I was, like, freaking out, you know? She laughed. No, no. Let's start slow, you know? Wear a dress this week and brush your hair next week. You know, really sarcastic like that. And then she goes, and shave your legs, Chewbacca. You know what I mean? It's like, it's summertime. You don't need to bulk up, you know? And I was terrified at the thought of pulling my hair away from my face, wearing a dress. You're nodding back there. I think I was 8 years sober before I wore pastel, you know, before I wore anything other than black. But anyway, it was terrifying to me. And if there's women in here that understand that, that whole concept of, I don't know how to be feminine, I don't know how to be a lady, I don't know how, to, I don't know, I don't even know if I know how to be a woman. I don't even know if I know how to be anything but sort of come here, get away, you know? I don't know if I know how to let you in. I can hang with the guys, I'm a great athlete, I'm a great tomboy, I'm all that stuff, but when it comes down to being pretty, it was terrifying to me. Because for me, I would never be able to be pretty enough, you know? And so, you just, you know, I don't want to like linger too long on that, but for women in recovery with our eating disorders and our skin and our age and da 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 da. And I don't know if you guys suffer from all that stuff, but I know for the girls, it's a hard place to find yourself and just be, you know? This love my chub on my thighs and my breasts are too small or they're too big or one's bigger than the other, you know, just uncomfortable in my own skin, you know? And as the years and I stay sober longer and longer, there's more truth about who Sammy is. And this is what I didn't share in the fourth step that I'm going to share with you guys today. And so the biggest thing that's coming, that I'm coming to grips with, is that, you're not going to like this either, that I am the one I've been waiting for, and that I am the love of my life. And I know it sounds corny and hokey and whatever else, but I believe that shit to my core. And I talk to myself differently today than I did years ago. Years ago, I would say this in the morning. Get up. Get the fuck up. You are so lazy. Do you know how many people are up and doing shit? You're not doing shit. You never do shit. You don't do enough. You never do enough. You know what? You didn't get anything done yesterday. Da-da-da, on and on and on. Today, here's I talk to me. Now this is, Arno's in the room, so it's like, this is so embarrassing for me to say. But he's back on his phone. He's distracted, but not really. He's totally here. I wake up and I go, Sammy, come on, baby. Come on, baby. Come on, sweetie, come on. I know you don't want to get up. I know it's hard. Come on, you got to do it. You can do it. You can do it. If you get up today, we can have ice cream. ice cream. Come on, baby, come on, let's do it. You got it, you're doing it. Yeah, sweet, good. It works for me. The other way seems like child abuse. I would never talk to a child that way. I would never talk to a human being that way. You know, and I know I'm not a child, and yet I am a child. I know I'm not a girl, and yet I am a girl. I'm a woman, and I'm a girl, and I'm a daughter, and, you know, and I'm a partner, and I'm a worker, and I'm a friend, and I'm one of God's kids, you know, and we all are. And so the deal that is to treat myself better, because if I'm not, I'm not treating you well. I have to treat you well and kindly, as lovingly as I can. And the best way is to secure my own oxygen mask before helping someone with theirs. And that's where this program gets selfish. Okay? I know that selfishness has a bad rap in this society, in all of our societies. That's selfish, that's selfish. Well, you know, on the plane, they ask you to secure your own oxygen mask before helping someone with theirs because they prefer that you not be selfless, and while you're trying to help everyone else with their oxygen mask, you pass out, go unconscious, no one can get out of the fucking plane, and the whole goddamn plane goes down. But you were selfless, you know what I mean? The fuck is that? I have to tend to the garden. My job is to keep the same phone number so that if you need me, when you're ready, you can call me. There are certain things I gotta do to keep that number the same. I've had the same cell phone number for 13 years, you know? That's amazing to me, you know? So there's these little things that have to get done. So I start working the steps. I go through Casa Serena. In 60 days, I'm done with the steps, and I'm also correspondingly kicked out because I'm too angry, which, you know, for me is like anger is when blood flows. But for me, it's not just like you lied, you know, living with 21 other women and we got issues. You know what I mean? I'm saying, so someone lied to me in a new recovery home where everyone's 5 minutes sober. The bitch lied to me. So I'm climbing over the dining room table like, I can't fucking lie, you know. And they said, this is like at 30 days sober because they gave me another chance. But anyways, and I heard from them what I've heard so many times on my report card since I was 5 years old. Samantha seems bright, a bit talkative, and at times inappropriate. You know, inappropriate's like my middle name. And which is why we laugh at the whole spiritual speaker thing, which, you know, whatever. So I get kicked out and I start couch surfing. And I'm just telling you that if you're in a recovery home, people a lot of times get confused that recovery home is the program. Recovery homes aren't the program. Recovery homes, hospitals, that's just the place where you store your shit while you go get sober. In AA, I think, right? So that's the deal. Don't get confused, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, that's where I get clean and sober. Everything else is just sort of like holding on. And they have rules, see, that AA doesn't have, because I don't get kicked out of AA. I've been asked, like, put the chair down. You know what I mean? Don't throw that. Put that down. I've been asked to make amends. I've been asked to, you know, keep coming back. I've been asked a lot of things in AA, but I've never been told I was too inappropriate for you. You may have thought it, but no one ever kicked me out. And where would I go? Where would I go? So I couch surfed and I ended up, you know, getting a job and I ended up going back to school and I ended up doing what other people were doing in front of me. I just sort of did what they did. I hung with the winners and I did what they did. I went where they went. If it was time to go get a doctor's exam, I went to the doctor's exam. If it was time to go to the California Department of Rehabilitation, I went to the rehabilitation place because they were all going to the rehabilitation place. I didn't even know what it was. But, you know, 15 months into my sobriety, the rehabilitation place calls me and says, your name's off the wait list, you can go to school. And I was like, is that what all that was about? I can go to school? They go, yeah. I go, well, I'm 15 months sober, and I have a job and stuff, so I probably don't qualify. And she goes, are you still an alcoholic? I go, yeah. She goes, are you still sober? I go, yeah. She goes, you qualify. So I went back to school, and I went through all through City College, and then I went to the big kids school at UCSB, and I graduated from UCSB, and then I started getting good at going to school. So when they graduated from there, I'm like, well, where else can I hide out? And I'm like, how about law school? Law school is a good place to hide out. So I went to law school. And I was asking my husband at the time, I'm like, what kind of law do you think I should practice? And he's like, Avi, criminal. You know what I mean? So I went to law school and I graduated from law school. And I started to study for the bar. And meanwhile, through law school, I had gotten a divorce. And that was a painful, like I said, a very painful situation. And I don't remember much about my last year of law school, nor do I remember much about studying for the bar. I just really wasn't present. But I studied for the bar. I didn't pass the bar. I took it again. I took it three times. And the end of the third time, I was already teaching college, and I love teaching college. And so my bosses there at college said, we want you to teach more. You need to go back to school and get an advanced degree in psychology. And I said, I'm studying for the bar. I'm going to be a lawyer. I got big plans. You know, I'm going to make some big money. And then this, not the other thing. I said, if I don't pass the bar this time, I will go ahead and I'll go back to school. So in 2007, I took the bar for the last time. I didn't pass. And that's kind of the thing. It's like, I mean, I'm not sure. I think I'm over it. I'm not really. I don't know. I'm trying to be honest. I know that I did not study the way a human being needs to study to pass that test. I could not make it the most important thing in my life. And I hope that's not sour grapes. I hope that's my truth. I mean, my truth is I just couldn't make it my priority. I had, you know, 13 sponsees, and I'm going to meetings, and I have a family, you know, my family and stuff. And it just, so I don't know if my life will be complete if I don't pass it, and I'm certainly open to doing it again. But as I'm teaching more and as I've gone back to school for my master's in psychology, it's like, it's a calling. And I love, love, love being a therapist. And I love, love, love what I've learned. The college that I go to is very Jungian based, so Carl Jung is like the big daddy. And so, of course, I have this love affair with Carl Jung already, just from this program. And then I get to really study and really study depth psychology, and we do a lot of dream analysis and a lot of myth and fairy tale. And a big part of what Jung teaches is that the wound, the brokenness of who we are, is actually the thing that holds the strength, the key, the answer. And it goes back to this wounded, the wounded healer, Chiron, who's in Greek mythology, and if you want, but it's so much of us. It's like every single one of you in this room is a wounded healer. You know what I mean? And that's a huge responsibility, but that's what we carry. We carry our brokenness into this room with another broken child, and we're like, we say the most powerful therapeutic words in the world. I understand. I know what you mean. I get you. I got it. I got you, bro. I got it. Totally. I know. I know. I know. That stuff does more than any insurance company, than any, you know, any self-help group, anything I've ever seen in my life is I understand. So I went back to school. I quit my job. My mom had had a stroke. My dad is in his 10th year of dementia. And my dad and me are like this. My dad is the... My dad is my boy. My dad is my man. He's a philosopher, and he's a teacher, and he's brilliant, and he's a doctor, and he's a healer, but he's the kind of healer that, you know, my earliest memories of him was about, how are we doing on time? Okay. He's the kind of guy that growing up, his waiting room would just be packed because he spent so much time talking to his patients, you know? And I remember him saying, she doesn't need a bone doctor, she needs a psychiatrist, you know? And he would tell the patients that. And then they'd say, I know, but Dr. Matern, but this, I just need to talk to you. I need to talk to you. And he'd say, okay, let's talk. And he was a religious man, but he's the kind of Christian that I see some wonderful people that they give Christianity a good name. They're the kind of people that I think Jesus would dig, you know, and they hang with. And that's kind of my dad. And anyways, so he's been losing his mind for the last 10 years. And it's a fascinating thing to watch, really. And so my mom is really broken physically. You know, she's had two strokes, and she has rheumatoid arthritis really bad. And she's like a little U. I mean, that's like her shape. I'm always saying, Ma, stand up, look me in the eye. Sometimes I got to get down like this, and I'll be like, what are you doing under there? You know? Stand up. And I have her doing yoga now and stuff. We have this yoga teacher that comes to the... This is the woman I hated, you know, that I would obsess about her death. And now my day is... my day is wrapped around, you know, at night I walk her into her bed. Dad's already in there usually talking to himself, and everything rhymes, you know. Samantha Louise makes love in the trees, you know. I go, I can neither confirm or deny that, sir, on the grounds that it will incriminate me. And he'll laugh, you know, and that mom and dad, they'll start singing these songs. And they've been going out, you know, they've been together for 60 years. And they still, you know, my mom, this is kind of gross, but whatever. My mom takes off her nightie and my dad's just like, woohoo, you know, and he like spanks her butt, you know. They're 83 and 81. And he's like, Mama, I love your boobies. I love your boobies. I love your boobies. She's like, I know, I know. Oh, Mama, I love your hiney. It's all miney, miney, you know. I'm like, la, la, la. And so my dad's in there, and he's shit himself all over the place. And so I run over there, and I pull him apart, and I take out the shit and clean him up. He's, what are you doing? I'm going to clean your butt. You got shit all over there. He's like, I do? I go, you do. You really do. And he's like, yeah, thank you so much. I go, oh, you did it for me, you know. So we clean the shit, and, you know, I have a doctorate degree, by the way. I should be making six figures, and this is what I do. I clean shit several times a day. It's a full-time job. And so we get the clean diapers on, get all that, and the dog's, like, sniffing in the diapers. Get out of the diapers, you know. And my mom's trying to get in because she still tries to do everything by herself, and she can't get her hand in the nightie. And so we're getting her hand in the nightie and getting her oxygen back on. And she loves those Vicks NyQuil things that you stick up your nose, you know, and I call it the snuffleupagus, you know. So I get her snuffleupagus and I shove that thing up her nose and her oxygen's on and I roll her little broken body into bed and she rolls over and my dad just wraps her up and they start spooning each other. And I take her face and I just give her this big, huge kiss and I'm just like, mmm. And before I can get my lips off her, my dad's like, I want one, you know. So I ran over to my dad, and when I was little, my dad would give these motorboat kisses to my sister and me that were just to die for, you know. You'd get him right here in the crook of the neck and just goosebumps all over the place, and it was like his beard would be all scratchy and all that stuff. And so I get in there, and I get into his neck, and I'm just like, and that's kind of like I did with Arno today. And I just... And I'm like licking his face and biting his ear, and he's just screaming, howling, laughing. My mom's laughing. The dogs are barking. The cat's like, whoopee. And I walk out the door, and, you know, I keep waiting to share and have this story be different. Because I know that the story doesn't have a really happy ending in a lot of ways, but I close the door, and all the thoughts of I'm not doing enough, and I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm not making any money. And I can't finish anything, and I'm struggling with this, and I can't really have a relationship right now because of whatever the deal is, and I'm the one I've been waiting for, and I'm the love of my life, and I've never been this old, and I've never been this sober, and I've never been here before, and I have no idea what I'm doing most of the time. I just don't know what I'm doing. And usually the voice comes back that says, you don't need to know. You're on a need-to-know basis. Right now, all you need to know is that you love these people, you give them dignity and respect, we laugh. And I close the door, and I say, whatever you want, God. Whatever you want. You sure this is what you want? Okay. And I go and I do whatever's the next thing to do, which is usually eating a lot of cookies and watching American Idol or some shit. You know, some spiritual shit. And then I get to come here and I get my cup filled up. And I get to tell you guys that I've never had it so good, no matter what my head says. And that this recipe of the steps is the most phenomenal thing that has changed the way I view life and the world and my creator. And that if it weren't for you and these rooms and those steps, I would have missed it all. Thanks for my life.